Coming up next is the Professor James McCanney Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, November 30th, 2006, and back to a normal week this week after Thanksgiving. Many topics to cover tonight, so I will be talking quickly. Once again, I will announce the main topic up front and then give some relevant news items first. The main science topic for tonight is, did the moon recently have an atmosphere and water? In other words, rain, rivers, lakes, ponds, erosion, etc. So that's the main science topic for tonight. Did the moon recently have an atmosphere? So there's many implications, of course, one of which being that there could have been travel between Earth and the moon. It would have been a very quick jumping off place for man to get started if it were compatible and not the barren, rocky, molten lava-ridden surface that we see today. But at any rate, onto a few first announcements. There's literally nothing going on in the schmooze news, science press, government-funded science these days, hitting an all-time low in activity. And, you know, I look around in both the science world and the journals, etc., and also in the popular media. But absolutely nothing going on that warrants the media to find out or to expose what is going on in the science world today. Reuters came out with an article this week dealing with science, the journal Science, and fraud regarding stem cell research. And I thought it was very odd because I talk about science and nature and the standard government mouthpiece, magazines, journals, if you want to call them that, which publish NASA information without any review at all. They take these articles, just put them in there. There's no review of any kind. There's no way for anybody else to get a word in edgewise. And certain people are just considered to be authorities in a field, and they are simply not questioned. So I found it comical that after a review by a panel, the journal Science claims that is going to curb fraud in its magazine, in its scientific journal. This is a Reuters issued statement this past week coming from a Donald Kennedy, editor-in-chief of Science, said that the prestigious journal accepted the major findings of a 6-member independent committee and pledged to craft new guidelines to guard against fraud. It sounds like a government agent or agency talking, how they're going to do an independent study or an internal study, and then, of course, they're going to craft new guidelines that will change this abuse in the future. But onwards, it says, the panel urged Science to devise a system to identify high-risk papers submitted for publication and give these studies extra scrutiny, such as demanding deeper access to data underpinning the findings. So that's very interesting, and one would assume that they would do that across the board with all papers to avoid fraud or misconceptions entering into the research field. However, it says, this is the funny part, it says papers deemed to be of high risk might include counterintuitive findings. Now, explain that to me as a scientist. Every scientist thinks that every other scientist's findings are counterintuitive. So, how are you going to figure that one out, Mr. Editor-in-Chief of Science? And then also, that research likely to generate intense media or political interest. Like papers regarding the 911 towers falling at the at a free fall rate. So basically what they're saying is that anything that doesn't fit their already normal schedule is going to be scrutinized more than other papers. Now, I get a real chuckle out of this last statement. Now, Kennedy said those submissions qualify for special attention. Said those submissions qualifying for special attention is likely to be a relatively small number, perhaps 10 a year or less, and might involve obvious controversial subjects such as stem cell research or climate change. So I found that interesting. So they're going to stay away from controversial topics. They're just going to publish the normal stuff, and everybody will be happy. Everybody be able to sleep tight, because science is a journal that's going to only publish normal accepted things. And so back to the space science astronomy community, once again, they won't be affected by this. And I get a kick out of this, because these journals are responsible for the tremendously bad science that permeates our entire society, whether it extends all the way out to the topic of extrasolar system objects, or whether it extends to the topic of Planet X, whether it extends to comets are dirty snowballs. What this does, in effect, is entrenches everybody who's already published in science. It makes it very difficult for new science to enter the arena. That is the end effect of science attempting to cure or curb fraud in its journal. So, like many agencies, what it does in time of stress and times when it's supposedly, or, you know, like this, they are in the forefront in the news for publishing basically garbage, they're going to hunker down and stay with the standard status quo, and that will make it safe for them. And understand that that's what the textbook companies do too. In fact, textbook companies have spent a great deal of time getting laws passed in just about every state saying that incorrect information cannot be published in a textbook. Well, in a field that's changing and potentially can have radical change, such as science, how can you pass such a law? Because that, what happens then is you have a standard body of authors. And when I did my astronomy textbook study in 1991, and oddly enough, in the 16 years since then, nothing has changed. You have teams of astronomers writing university-level astronomy textbooks. And I, in 1991, I was teaching university-level, college-level astronomy. And so I ordered all the textbooks from all of the companies that published astronomy textbooks for the college university level. And I made a video that was funded by a research grant. And that is, in fact, the video that's on my list called Astronomy for the 90s. That was produced professionally under the grant. But the point was, I took all the textbooks and showed how they were equivalent, and that one author of one textbook would edit the textbook of another set of authors, etc. So the end result was you had a uniform set of astronomical theories in the textbooks. And the textbook companies liked this, because then they could put their stamp of approval on it and sell textbooks. It's quite an amazing system. The end result, however, is the public gets garbage, and these are the standard axioms of astronomy, and all the little band-aid theories that go along with them regarding how the solar system formed, what comets are, how Venus got to be where it is today, and on and on and on. So once again, science doing an internal study, the only effect will be to entrench the people that are already there. And just an aside note, there's been an increase in funding in science over the past years, but that increase in funding only tends to support and enhance the people that are already entrenched. They get more money, it entrenches their ideas more, and the ideas that come in from outside are blocked to a higher degree. The next point I want to make is that the Planet X disinformation crew, this is for people who are somewhat new to this, to my listening audience, and every week there are many new people, so I try and include something that that you possibly are not aware of. The idea of Planet X, there's an object, or many objects, as I say, there is not just one. There are many extrasolar system objects that in the past have come in and done damage to our inner solar system, and those objects can come back in the future, and there may be objects coming in to our solar system that have never been here before. So the idea is that the standard scientific community, mainly run by NASA and its disinformation crew, they basically don't want you to know about this or think about this, because they know the one thing that will turn everybody's head on this planet is if they look someday into the sky and see a giant raging comet. And these planets will not be round. That's one of the other disinformation ploys they've used, is to make you think that something is going to be round up there, if it's a new object or a new potentially damaging object in the solar system. And the fact is that they will look like comets. They will be comets, large comets. And there again, that's one of the reasons why they maintain this ridiculous dirty snowball comet model, is because then they can point to that, and if something big turns up in the sky, they'll say, oh, don't look at that, it's just one of those dirty snowballs, it's just a little bit bigger than normal. But on the same line, this past week I got a kick out of this article on space.com, another one of the government mouthpiece web news agencies. An article comes out, and this is written in classic disinformation style. It says, a study shows galactic baby boom influenced life on Earth. So this would imply that something from outer space influenced life on Earth. But they always talk about something far away and long ago, as I always say. So they say 2.4 billion years ago, the Milky Way started producing more stars, and therefore high-speed atomic particles came pouring onto our planet, causing instability with the living populations of bacteria, which repeatedly soared and crashed in the oceans. These populations changed, they're saying. And so at any rate, it goes on about a study of seashells, and it says, according to one theory, when a star explodes far away in the Milky Way, cosmic rays penetrate through the Earth's atmosphere and produce ions and free electrons. The released electrons act as catalysts, therefore the cosmic rays increase cloud cover on Earth, reflecting sunlight, keeping the planet relatively cool. So it goes on and on. But the problem here is, once again, they take a topic which should be talking about the real influences on life, the cataclysmic influences of large foreign objects coming into our solar system and affecting the planet Earth. And what are they talking about? Something 2.4 billion years ago, something that most people can't even comprehend or don't want to, and then they talk about seashells being affected. So once again, space.com, and this is very subtle. Most people would read this and pretty much say, so what? And that's what they want. But the end effect is that all that cosmic stuff out there that could affect Earth happened long ago and far away in a galaxy not very near yours. So at any rate, the next topic I want to talk about is the upcoming contrived global water shortage. Now, I did a show a number of weeks ago on this, and I'm going to be doing quite a bit more information on this topic. But the one thing that you should remember and take away with you is that soon you are going to be your only source of clean and pure water. And the problem with, you may say, well, I have a water filter on my water system at home, on the faucet, or I have, a very high-end expensive one for the whole house that's in the basement. This is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about in terms of emergency. And there's one problem with a system that's on a pressurized system, as in your house. If the filter breaks or has a small crack in it, then all of the water that's being filtered is going to pour through that little crack, and your filter is basically worthless. So I've never been a proponent of inlined water filters. I use them for a crude filter sometimes in remote places just to get the cobwebs out, so to speak, the gunk, the residue in water, the big stuff. But then I take it and I pour it through a gravity water filter. Now, the difference is with a gravity filter, the water filters relatively slowly. There's no pressure. There are no electric or moving parts. There's no pressure. And the water simply filters through elements, and there's no chance that your filtering element will be broken due to the pressure, etc. But there's a new law that just came out that says they can put fluoride in bottled water. Now, once again, I have a water filter that I have on my webpage, and I also have an 800 number. It's called the Berkey, and I've done a bit of research on water, and this filter is the one that I personally choose for myself. And then the time's coming up, as I said, your only source of clean, pure water will be your own water filter. You don't know what is going to be put in city water, your local water supplier, and this would be possibly one of the future control points for the public. And this is what I was talking about, the contrived world water shortage. How on earth could we have a water shortage when there, in fact, is the planet is covered with water? There's so much water out there. In fact, most of the planet's surface is water. But, and there's tremendous amounts of fresh water locked in the ice caps. We do have plenty of rainwater. It's just not properly directed. But there are increasingly stringent laws about collecting water, or saving water, or having water. So, at any rate, as I said, your only source of fresh water will be your own gravity water filter. And once again, I'll just quickly give out some basic information. I have an 800 number you can call. It's 800-983-5622. That's 800-983-5622. And there's a little information on there, and that's a call center where you can actually order the Berkey water filter. They're $315, and that includes two filters with the water filter. Excuse me. A little sneeze there. That includes two water filters and two extra ones, which I contend that you will need in case of an emergency. 0911 emergency shortwave radio that you can listen to this radio show on. That's free with the Berkey water filter and free shipping to the 50 states. Also, go to my webpage, and that is www.jmccsci.com, and all the information is there, and including my books, videotapes, etc. And also, for people who like to use mail order, my address is JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. And if you send $315, you get the same Berkey water filter offer, including the free radio and free shipping to the 50 states. Something that I highly recommend that everybody get is that Berkey water filter. Also, I've noticed people like to use mail order for ordering my books. If you're new to my information, there's two possibilities. Order the four-book set. This would get you started in understanding the electrical nature of the solar system. The four-book set is $60. That includes shipping. Or just order the weather book to get started, $25, and that includes shipping. Once again, to JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. On to the next topic. Interestingly enough, this is a little political commentary, because a lot of people that I talk to are tuned to the political scenarios going on in the world. And, of course, this is related to science, because it's the scientists are the people who make the political world possible by creating technology used by people in power to stay in power. But it's interesting, all of the activity of political leaders flying to the Mideast when they could just pick up and have a phone conversation. Apparently they don't even trust their own secure phone networks anymore, having to fly around having meetings. And the end result is that a lot of people think that something is amiss, another planned terrorist activity, because the public is getting very agitated with the what you might call foreign policy or lack thereof. So another reason for you to be prepared. And one of the best ways to prepare is have seeds for sprouts. And this would be like something that I use that I don't sell, is Texas wheatgrass. It's a way of sprouting wheat and providing a very stable food source in times of dire stress. Also, you need water for that, clean water. Once again, the water filter. Water is the most important item you're going to have one day, and your own gravity feed water filter is going to be your only source of clean water. Once again, that's related to politics. How is that related to science? Well, as I said, the technology used to keep people in power is made by scientists. Your friendly local scientist that got a PhD in your local university spends his time going around identifying water sources. And what is that used for? The geologists who do that, or find oil, that's used by large corporations, not to help you out, but to control and manipulate the public. This past week, a very interesting article came out in the Tampa Tribune, and this was highlighted one morning, the 27th of November. This was the article came out, the Tampa Tribune, entitled "Hurricane Predictions Off Track as Tranquil Season Wafts Away." And, of course, I was saying this all this season regarding the NOAA, National Weather Service, National Hurricane Prediction Center, predictions that this would be a bigger year than even 2005. And, of course, they were fear-mongering with no real ability to predict, no real knowledge, no real theoretical basis with which to predict hurricanes, the Atlantic hurricane season. And let me just review for those people that are new to the show. For more information on this, you can go to my weather book, The Principia Meteorologia, The Physics of Sun-Earth Weather. We just call it the weather book. But The weather book goes into a great amount of detail on how the National Weather Service makes their predictions, and then it talks about how I make my predictions. But I'm going to summarize this just for this show for people who are somewhat new to this topic. The National Weather Service makes its predictions based on past years. And so what they do is they have vast computer arrays and they put in all kinds of data, most of it totally irrelevant, and they come up with a prediction. But basically, they make their prediction based on last year. And here's what it would be equivalent to. Say you went to Las Vegas and you were a gambler and you wanted to predict what this next gambling season would be like. You would possibly take the results from the past 10 gambling seasons, average them together, and say, this is what we predict for this coming gambling season. Well, that's what NOAA does for its predictions regarding the hurricane season. And you look at the factors that they list, and I go through all of these in my weather book, but they talk about the ocean salt content. They talk about ocean currents. They talk about El Nino. None of these factors have anything to do with hurricanes or hurricane development. Hurricanes are developed on this planet by electrical conditions that come from outside the planet. Very pure and simple. And so they have absolutely nothing to do with the factors that NOAA is using. So all of their computer programs are pretty much worthless. So when they came out this year and made a prediction for this huge, fantastic hurricane season, I made my own prediction, and that I did actually one night. I was just talking with a friend of mine. He's a host on a local radio show, Brad Walton. He's a host on WCCO Radio, which is a local station here. But after 9 o'clock at night, they are able to turn up the power on their station to the full 50,000 watts and cover a 38 state area. So when they do that, I'm on with Brad as a guest, and one night we were talking, and he was just recounting this to me this past week. We were having a conversation, and he said, "Yeah, I remember when you made your prediction for 2006 on the radio, and I had said that it would be a pretty much a nothing year for hurricanes because the solar electrical alignments simply weren't going to be there." And I said, there might be one late date in November, but that's pretty sketchy. All of the factors are not there that you would normally expect. But at any rate, we pretty much had a nothing season. And the reason predicting has become difficult in past years is because of storm manipulation. Using satellite lasers as a method of cranking up storms, all of the storms you saw, in the 2004 season and the 2005 season, a great majority of those storms were manipulated, and especially the big ones like Katrina and Rita and on. I've talked about those before. So when I talk about weather prediction and hurricane prediction, I'm talking about the electrical factors in the solar system, which I can chart and look up using astronomical information about the positions of various objects and electrical currents in the solar system. Now, these are not gravitational alignments. These are electrical alignments. They're very different than the old... there used to be a lot of... There used to be a lot of people that would say, oh, there's going to be an alignment with Mars and Earth is going to have devastating, or there was once one where all the planets were going to line up and everybody was going to die. And of course, nothing happened. And so this has raised the eye of the public and debunkers that work for the government, showing that these planetary alignments offer nothing to as far as Earth effects. But there are electrical effects, and they're very different. And predicting predicting electrical effects in the solar system is a very different business. So, at any rate, I use electrical conditions in the solar system and other properties of the electrical nature of the solar system to make my hurricane predictions. And by the way, I'll be making some analysis of 2007. And in terms of predictions, weather prediction is always an iffy business, but with certain fundamental knowledge, you can make very, very good predictions, which I've done in the past. Very notably, I'm not going to go into that detail. Once again, those details are in my weather book. But the point being that in this article, the Tampa Tribune, November 27th article, they were kind of, I wouldn't say scolding, but they were talking about how ridiculous the national weather prediction was from the, in the 2006 season. But then they go on and they interviewed some of the scientists, and this is the humorous part of this article, where the scientists who made the predictions, Dr. Gray and his team, started coming up with all the excuses. And they said, oh, well, the first excuse I really love. They said the storms were starved for fuel after ingesting masses of dry Saharan dust and air over the Atlantic Oceans. The storm-snuffing dust was more abundant than usual this year. Well, I want to talk about this point specifically because this idea that dust from the Sahara Desert influences hurricanes, first of all, the Sahara is very far north. And typically the dust from the Sahara is moving in the temperate latitude jet stream, not the tropical jet stream that comes through the equator. But be that as it may, there was a concept, a theoretical idea that was proposed about the middle of last summer, stating that possibly dust from the Sahara Desert could influence hurricane strength. But nobody ever did the follow-up research to show or not show, as the case may be, that Sahara dust had a pattern of influencing storms in the past. That would be the requisite for understanding an empirical relationship between Sahara dust and hurricanes, first of all. But then you have to find a cause and effect, scientific explanation for why dust from the Sahara Desert would influence hurricanes at all. None of this follow-up work was ever done. But so I find it almost humorous that as these scientists from NOAA grapple for excuses for why their predictions were so ridiculous, the first thing they grab is Sahara dust. Do these people really get paid for this? They do. And next year they will get a paycheck too. Now, it also talks about the storms curving up into the Atlantic. And then the scientists say, well, there were high-pressure cells that normally hang around the Bermuda area, and these had shifted eastwards so that, therefore, the storm systems moved up into the Atlantic instead. Well, there again, I would like to talk about Hurricane Wilma in the 2005 season that sat off of Yucatan, Mexico for 5 days in one spot as a 600-mile-per-hour jet stream raced over the top of it, and when they finally released it from the satellite, from the laser satellite manipulation, it went racing up past Florida and up the East Coast at nearly 45 miles per hour, an unheard-of speed for a hurricane to move, but it did. Once they let it go and it got into the jet stream that carried it at a very high velocity. Yet they were able to hold that storm off of Cancun for 5 days, holding it in that that very intense jet stream. And why did they hold a storm off of Cancun? Because they wanted it devastated so that the World Bank could come in and give them loans to fix it up. And guess who's going to be indebted to the World Bank? All of the major players in Cancun. Very interesting. But anyway, back to the final reason why supposedly we had a very poor 2006 showing for hurricanes is the rapidly growing El Nino. One of the biggest hoaxes ever promoted by any scientific group ever. Talk about a hand-waving argument. A patch of warm water out in the Pacific supposedly influencing storms, Atlantic hurricanes. And understand that in the El Nino region in the Pacific, when it does occur, those influences move westward off to Asia, not eastward. Some of the storms spin off of that region and move north up through the United States, and their influence typically ends up in the far North Atlantic. It has nothing to do with hurricane development along the equator in the Atlantic, but scientists have been using this ridiculous idea for decades, and somehow coupling it into hurricane development in the Atlantic. But at any rate, I'm going to get off of this topic. But the real reason for the low hurricane turnout in 2006 was that there simply were no conditions for hurricanes to form electrically. The electrical conditions in the solar system were simply not there, as I pointed out, as I said with Brad Walton, early in the season, and probably that was, I would say maybe March of the 2006 season before the hurricane season started. He asked me on the air, said, what would I predict for 2006? I said, well, it's going to be a nothing season, but you have to understand that if there's manipulation going on, then how can you predict? What's funny about the 2005 season is that NOAA made their standard prediction, and then as the season went on and we had more and more hurricane seasons, we had a bumper crop of manipulated storms, they started upping their predictions every month. They would change their prediction and alter it, and even by the end of the season they were totally wrong. Well, in 2006, they were lowering their prediction every month, and even at the end of the season, they were still off. They were still double the number of predicted storms and hurricanes than what actually happened. And they were calling every little thunderstorm a tropical storm just to get something named out there. Remember that the storms they called tropical storms weren't tropical storms at all in 2006. So they really didn't have any storms this year. There were a couple tropical storms that hit Florida, Alberto and Ernesto, but once again, not anything like the storms that we were seeing in previous years. So once again, I'll be coming out with some scientific information on the 2007 season, the electrical conditions that would influence hurricane and severe storm development. On to the main science topic for the night. Did the moon recently have an atmosphere? It's very interesting. And what cued me onto this subject, something that I have talked about in the past, but something that I wanted to concentrate on this show, is a magazine called Physics Today, which I get because I'm in the physics community, had a picture. It had a picture of, the article was about putting telescopes on the moon. And they showed a crater, very dark, where they might put a telescope someday, they're thinking. But the crater is filled with lava, fresh lava. On the moon, fresh lava looks much darker than the rest of the surface. But what was very interesting in the picture was that there were, I counted, 22 water erosion features in the picture that they showed. And this is just a little teeny patch of the moon, one crater, one small crater, where they were talking about possibly putting a telescope someday. And frankly, I don't think putting a telescope on the moon is a very good idea at all. And oddly enough, I talked in the past week about the NASA study claiming that dust would be a severe problem for anything on the moon. So why on earth would you ever consider putting a telescope on the moon with all of the dust problems on the moon? Anyway, obviously the right and left hand of the government scientific world don't have a clue what the other one is doing. But be that as it may, 22 water erosion features in this picture. And these were washes, these were rivers, these were areas that were obviously part of a water system. There were water deltas flowing into one region. 22 of these on just this little picture of one little crater on the moon. And of course, you can go over the detailed pictures of the moon, the ones that we got before they started washing these features out, Adobe Photoshopping them out, with all kinds of unusual features on the moon only attributable to erosion or water activity. So the question is, could the moon have had an ocean and atmosphere recently, and understand the connection between atmosphere and water? You need an atmosphere, a relatively significant atmosphere, to hold the water in place. If for some reason the atmosphere leaves, then the water is going to evaporate off relatively quickly and is simply going to go away. Some of it could freeze on the surface, but in general, the water would not last long on the surface and simply would be gone. It would evaporate away. And the question is, if it had an atmosphere, then it must have had it for some length of time. If it had the water, it must have had that for some length of time. So how exactly could these features of the moon be attributable to recent activity? Well, remember that the ancients talked about the moon turning to blood. And this can be interpreted as rivers of volcanic flow. When the catastrophe hit, when the comet came by, and this was the recent one, the comet that became the planet Venus in the Velikovsky scenario, this could have been as early as 4,000 years ago. And once again, I don't like putting dates on these events, but it was within the memory of mankind. And this is Velikovsky's main point, of course, and there is a good deal of evidence to support that. But be that as it may, certainly within the past 10,000 years, Earth has had a major catastrophe caused by a large celestial object in the form of a comet coming by Earth. Now, the question is, did the moon recently have an atmosphere? So we have a number of things that could have happened. Along with the passage, there was going to be a pummeling of meteorites and meteors. The moon would have changed its surface. Also, there could have been a good deal of fissuring in the surface of the moon. So a lot of the features, the what we call the seas of the moon, are recent volcanic flows. The reason we know they're recent is because they do not show the cratering. And it's interesting to see Mars is the same way. The lowlands on Mars, you can tell them right away from a distant picture or close-up photography of Mars, from the satellite imagery orbiting Mars, you can tell the lowlands because there are no craters or very few craters, whereas the highlands are very heavily cratered. And of course, the reason the lowlands are not heavily cratered is because the oceans were there to the environment to remove the crater features in an active environment. So once again, that's very indicative that Mars had that those conditions. So here's the scenario. Let's look at an entire scenario for the Moon having an atmosphere and water recently. And this, of course, has implications for the Earth population that existed prior to that. Could they have seen that Moon up there with water and oceans and said, we want to go there, and built a spacefaring capability to get there? And once they were out there, they would realize, hey, we can go farther. We can go to Mars. We know that Mars had oceans and atmospheres as recently as within the past 10,000 years. Because there, it is reported that Mars was a blue planet. Mars was a water planet, and you see this indicator of that water all over the place. You see the water flows, the erosion, like on Olympus Mons. So Mars had a significant atmosphere recently. And the reason you know it was recent is because a lot of the features on Mars, the pristine river beds, etc., that wind across the surface of Mars, would have been destroyed by the tremendous dust storms that occur on a regular basis on Mars. So we know that Mars recently had water. Well, let's go back to the Moon. Here would be the scenario. The Moon is very much an Earth-like planet with water, and maybe shallow, not a lot of water, but an atmosphere, and rain and clouds and activity just like Earth. And now, the Moon is sitting out there somewhat all by itself, a quarter million miles away, about 258,000 miles away from Earth. And it's sitting there. It's a very nicely formed planet. I always call Earth the Moon system. I really don't call it a moon. I call this a twin planet system, and the Moon should literally be classified as another planet. But be that as it may, the Moon in this scenario would have had water. It would have had an atmosphere, and remember, it's sitting out there somewhat by itself. Now, when Venus came by Mars, the comet, you look at the size of Venus today. It is larger than Mars. It has a higher surface gravity. So when the large comet Nucleus came by, it would have drawn, once the electrical plasma connection was made, it would have drawn the atmosphere and oceans off of Mars in a couple hours. And this is actually reported by the ancients. It's one of the very startling revelations that Velikovsky discovered in the ancient literature. But the Moon is in the same situation, although smaller. So it would have been a much easier scenario to believe that the Moon had water recently and atmosphere, and it lost it as Venus, the large comet, came by. Now, why didn't Earth lose its atmosphere? Because Venus is slightly smaller than Earth. It has less mass, and it has a lower surface gravity than Earth. So Venus coming by Earth would have pulled a lot of material in from the comet, which it did. That was the vast pollution event, the water, the flood, the great flood. And I always get a kick out of people who try and minimize the great flood and say, oh, it was just a breach of land somewhere in the Mideast, and a wall of water came across a certain part of the Mideast, and that's what people are recording. Well, that's absolutely ludicrous, because the Great Flood specifically talks about rain. It rained for 40 days and 40 nights, and it didn't stop, and it wasn't a light rain. It poured for 40 days and 40 nights. Can you imagine that much water coming down from the sky all over the world? The entire world reports this. So Earth was stuck in the tail of that large comet for a period of 40 days, and that makes sense. That's about the time Earth would spend in a large comet tail in the case of Venus. Now, what would happen to the moon? The moon would lose its atmosphere. So it loses the ability to hold water and to create an atmospheric weather system, whereas Earth is being polluted by a tremendous amount, a tremendous addition of water. The poles on Earth are shifted by about 30 to 35 degrees due to the gravitational wave coming by, and the moon's orbit could be thrown off. Remember that the moon's orbit is off of the Earth's orbit, equatorial orbit, by 6 degrees. And that's why the moon sometimes looks high in the sky and sometimes it looks almost like it's down on the horizon, is because of the attitude of Earth and the moon and the way their orbits are set up. If the moon had formed with the Earth, and as the textbook explanation would want you to believe, then the moon should be in an ecliptic orbit. It should be in an orbit, and also the Earth's equator should point north and south in the solar system. It does not. It's tilted at 23.5 degrees, and the moon's orbit is tilted 6 degrees from that. So, for that reason, the moon's orbit certainly is not the same orbit that it would have had if it formed in this scenario that the standard textbooks want you to believe, that the Earth and the moon and all the planets formed at one time. Clearly something big has happened since then to change the moon's orbit, to change the tilt of the Earth, the rotational axis of the Earth, etc. So, and by the way, the other planets do not align with the axis of the solar system, the axis of the sun. The only one that really does is Jupiter, and that's off by about 1%. And the Jupiter being the original planet or twin star of our star coming out of the galactic nucleus when they formed, the original twin star system with all of the other planets being captured at a later date. So, once again, this is back to the scenario with the moon. Now, what would that mean prior to this event? Prior to this event, the moon has an atmosphere, it has erosion, and it has river systems, it has deltas where washes come down and dump into reservoirs, whether they be lakes or oceans or ponds or whatever you want to call them, and these are very visible. As I said, on the one small patch of the moon, which I saw in this photo in Physics Today, 22 water erosion features on that small photograph alone. So the moon is literally covered with water erosion features, but a lot of times you'll see a crater punching right in the middle of one of them. And there again, that could be from the recent bombardment of the moon during such an event. Or also the eruption of volcanic lava flows, which occurred during the same time. So the surface of the moon would be altered, changed, but a lot of these residual features would still be there. And remember that if this happened many times in the past, then some of these features may be residuals from earlier epochs when the moon had an atmosphere, etc. Now, what's clear to me is that the moon is regaining its atmosphere, just like Mars is regaining its atmosphere. Mars has doubled its atmospheric content over the past 10 years. So the moon would be doing the same, but it's going to take a very long time for these to build up any type of atmosphere like they had prior to the Venus event. And so, the three stages. Prior to the event, the moon has an atmosphere. It's been pummeled many times. The moon would probably have a much thinner atmosphere than Earth, although it's very interesting to note that even though Venus is much smaller than Earth, has a lower surface gravity, its atmosphere is far larger, far denser than Earth's, implying that it's much newer. And it's also very extremely hot. So, once again, this scenario actually is a better explanation of what happened recently in our solar system than anything you're going to read in a standard textbook on astronomy or space science. Now, looking at the event, as I said, the moon would go under, it would lose its atmosphere, lose its oceans, volcanic eruptions, possibly some cratering, altering the surface of the moon the way we see it today, the large Mars filling up with fresh volcanic flows, and looking today as if they're smooth lake beds. After the event, the moon is left with no atmosphere. Basically, little has changed since that event. So the moon is basically the same as it was at the time that event occurred, although it's gaining a bit of atmosphere, as I said, but not enough to actually affect erosion or any other features like that. So the point is, if there were a moon today, or in a society as we have, that was spacefaring, technologically advanced, and remember that to go into space, you don't need computers. You don't need all of the stuff that NASA has. In fact, the Russians did quite nicely in their space program throughout the 60s and 70s without much computer activity at all. They were flying by wire. They were actually, to turn a valve, they would go up and turn a valve. They wouldn't depend on a computer automated circuit to do this for them. Everything was manual. They had their tasks. Open up this oxygen control valve. Close that one over there. And if you look at the actual spacecraft, the Russian spacecraft, they were individual modules all hooked together. Their redundancy was in the fact that they had many oxygen systems, for example, on their spacecraft. So the point is, you don't need computers, you don't need a lot of high technology to go into space. This is one of the other NASA misnomers, that you somehow need all of this high-tech stuff to go into space. And it would be, and I've done shows on this in the past, taking a primitive society with the ability to manufacture and materials, a knowledge of materials, how could they go into space? And it's really not that difficult. Using electromagnetic propulsion systems, using glass, etc. So, given an ancient technology, say Atlantis, the Atlanteans, could they have been spacefaring? And if you had a moon, this is the point, if you had a moon that was a water planet just like ours, it would give you a much greater incentive to go there. It would give you the belief that the moon is just like here. It probably had an atmospheric content very similar to Earth, and so you could actually go there and walk around on the planet just as you do on Earth. And, of course, Mars being the very next step. With the current space program, in 20 years, I doubt if NASA will ever get to the moon. But that's why I keep saying we have to have private space programs, and that's why I work daily and in the background to make that happen. Once again, I am out of time. Join me next week as once again I explore the scientific realities of our universe. Once again, this is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.